7th. In China, we find a social system travelling along yet another, and only a very roughly parallel line to that followed by the Indian and Western civilizations. The Chinese civilization, even more than the Hindu, is organized for peace, and the warrior plays a small part in its social scheme. As in the Indian civilization, the leading class is an intellectual one, less priestly than the Brahmin and more official. But unlike the Brahmins, the Mandarins, who are the literate men of China, aren't a caste. One isn't a Mandarin by birth, but by education. They're drawn by education and examination from all classes of the community, and the son of a Mandarin has no prescriptive right to succeed his father. As a consequence of these differences, while the Brahmins of India are, as a class, ignorant even of their own sacred books, mentally slack and full of a pretentious assurance, the Chinese Mandarin has the energy that comes from hard mental work. But since his education so far has been almost entirely a scholarly study of the classical Chinese literature, his influence has been entirely conservative. Before the days of Alexander the Great, China had already formed itself and set its feet in the way in which it was still walking in the year 1000 AD. Invaders and dynasties had come and gone, but the routine of life of the yellow civilization remained unchanged. The traditional Chinese social system recognized four main classes below the priest-emperor. First, the literary class, which was equivalent partly to the officials of the Western world and partly to its teachers and clerics. In the time of Confucius, its education included archery and horsemanship, rites and music, history and mathematics completed the six accomplishments. Second, the cultivators of the land. Third, the artisans. Fourth, the mercantile class. But since from the earliest times it has been the Chinese way to divide the landed possessions of a man among all his sons, there has never been in Chinese history any class of great landowners renting their land to tenants, such as most other countries have displayed. The Chinese land has always been cut up into small holdings, which are chiefly freeholds and cultivated intensively. There are landlords in China who own one or a few farms and rent them to tenants, but there are no great permanent estates. When a patch of land by repeated division is too small to sustain a man, it's sold to some prospering neighbor, and the former owner drifts to one of the great towns of China to join the mass of wage-earning workers there. In China, for many centuries, there have been these masses of town population with scarcely any property at all, men neither serfs nor slaves, but held to their daily work by their utter impecuniousness. From such masses it is that the soldiers needed by the Chinese government are recruited, and also such gang labor as has been needed for the making of canals, the building of walls, and the like has been drawn. The war captive and the slave class play a smaller part in Chinese history than in any more westerly record of these ages before the Christian era. One fact we may note is common to all these three stories of developing social structure, and that is the immense power exercised by the educated class in the early stages before the crown or the commonalty began to read and consequently to think for itself. In India, by reason of their exclusiveness, the Brahmins, the educated class, retain their influence to this day. Over the masses of China, along entirely different lines, and because of the complexities of the written language, the Mandarinate has prevailed. The diversity of race and tradition in the more various and eventful world of the West has delayed and perhaps arrested forever any parallel organization of the specially intellectual elements of society into a class ascendancy. In the Western world, as we've already noted, education early slopped over and soaked away out of the control of any special class. It escaped from the limitation of castes and priesthoods and traditions into the general life of the community. Writing and reading had been simplified down to a point when it was no longer possible to make a cult and mystery of them. It may be due to the peculiar elaboration and difficulty of the Chinese characters, rather than to any racial difference, that the same thing didn't happen to the same extent in China. 8. In these last 6 chapters, we've traced in outline the whole process by which in the course of 5,000 or 6,000 years, that's to say, in something between 150 and 200 generations, mankind passed from the stage of early Neolithic husbandry, in which the primitive skin-clad family tribe reaped and stored in their rude mud huts the wild-growing fodder and grain-bearing grasses with sickles of stone, to the days of the 4th century BC, when all round the shores of the Mediterranean and up the Nile, and across Asia to India, and again over the great alluvial areas of China, spread the fields of human cultivation and busy cities, great temples, and the coming and going of human commerce. Galleys and Latin-sailed ships entered and left crowded harbours, and made their careful way from headland to headland, and from headland to island, keeping always close to the land. Phoenician shipping under Egyptian owners was making its way into the East Indies, and perhaps even further into the Pacific. Across the deserts of Africa and Arabia, and through Turkestan, toiled the caravans with their remote trade. Silk was already coming from China, ivory from Central Africa, and tin from Britain, to the centres of this new life in the world. Men had learned to weave fine linen and delicate fabrics of coloured wool. They could bleach and dye. They had iron as well as copper, bronze, silver, and gold. They had made the most beautiful pottery and porcelain. There was hardly a variety of precious stone in the world that they hadn't found and cut and polished. They could read and write, divert the course of rivers, pile pyramids, and make walls 1,000 miles long. The 50 or 60 centuries in which all this had to be achieved may seem a long time in comparison with the 70 years of a single human life, but it's utterly inconsiderable in comparison with the stretches of geological time. Measuring backward from these Alexandrian cities to the days of the first stone implements, the rostro-carinate implements of the Pliocene Age, gives us an extent of time fully 100 times as long. We've tried in this account, and with the help of maps and figures and time charts, to give a just idea of the order and shape of these 50 or 60 centuries. Our business is with that outline. We've named but a few names of individuals, though henceforth the personal names must increase in number. But the content of this outline that we've drawn here in a few diagrams and charts can't but touch the imagination. If only we could look closelier, we could see through all these 60 centuries a procession of lives more and more akin in their fashion to our own. We've shown how the naked Paleolithic savage gave place to the Neolithic cultivator, a type of man still to be found in the backward places of the world. We've given an illustration of Sumerian soldiers, copied from a carved stone that was set up long before the days when the Semitic Sargon I conquered the land. Day by day, some busy brownish man carved those figures, and no doubt whistled as he carved. In those days, the plain of the Egyptian delta was crowded with gangs of swarthy workmen unloading the stone that had come down the Nile to add a fresh course to the current pyramid. One may paint 1,000 scenes from those ages, of some hawker merchant in Egypt spreading his stock of Babylonish garments before the eyes of some pretty rich lady, of a miscellaneous crowd swarming between the pylons to some temple festival at Thebes, of an excited, dark-eyed audience of Cretans like the Spaniards of today, watching a bullfight, with the bullfighters in trousers and tightly girded, exactly like any contemporary bullfighter, of children learning their cuneiform signs. At Nippur, the clay exercise tiles of a school have been found, of a woman with a sick husband at home slipping into some great temple in Carthage to make a vow for his recovery. Or perhaps it's a wild Greek, skin-clad and armed with a bronze axe, standing motionless on some Illyrian mountain crest, struck with amazement at his first vision of a many-oared Cretan galley crawling like a great insect across the amethystine mirror of the Adriatic Sea. He went home to tell his folk a strange story of a monster, Briareus with his 100 arms, of millions of such stitches in each of these 200 generations is the fabric of this history woven. But unless they mark the presence of a primary seam or join, we can't pause now to examine any of those stitches.